Good afternoon. Welcome to the Second Court of Appeals. We have two cases set for oral submission this afternoon on the 1:30 docket. And for our 3 o'clock docket, we have no cases set for oral submission. Your panel this afternoon is to my right, Justice Sue Walker. To my left, Justice Lee Gabriel. I'm Leanne Dofino. Understand everybody has announced ready, so we'll go ahead and get started. If you call the first case.
The court called Rhonda Terry McCallahan versus Walmart Stores and Assembled Products Corporation.
All right. Coming up, when you start talking, the light will go on.
Well, may it please the court. I'm Dylan Drubman. It's my pleasure to be here today to represent Ms. Terry Mulcahy in this matter. The central issue that is before the court as part of this appeal is whether the trial court below abused its discretion when it denied her motion to continue the hearing on the appellee's no evidence summary judgments, given that an adequate time for discovery could not have elapsed, in that it was a relatively short amount of time that the case had been active, she had had new counsel that had just appeared 5 business days prior to the summary judgment hearing. And given that her trial counsel failed to act in a competent, diligent, or prompt manner in derogation of the Texas disciplinary rules of professional conduct. I'd like to begin today by addressing a few of the factors of the adequate time for discovery test as laid out in Specialty Retailers v. Fuqua from the Houston Court of Appeals, the 14th Court, and particularly those prongs which have had the most debate in the briefing here before the court. The third prong of the Fuqua test addresses the length of time that the case was active. And there are, you know, several cases cited in each of our briefs that kind of detail what that spectrum of time looks like, ranging from 60 months to 50 to 40 to 30 to even 20 and even some that are less. It's this third prong that's of note here in that one of the cases that is that in fact had, you know, which may arguably be an outlier case, that had the longest time that a case had been active was 60 months, was the Inri ROC pretrial case, came out of the San Antonio Court of Appeals in 2004, was actually a products liability case, which is one of the causes of action that Ms. Mulcahy has asserted against Assembled Products. There are two cases that were cited both in our briefing and in Walmart's briefing, which I want to address specifically. One was the Carter v. McFadden case that came out of the Houston court, authored by Judge Brister while he was still in Houston, where there had been a pro se litigant who had been pro se for the entire 8 months that this case had been active prior to the motion for summary judgment having been filed. Needless to say, the court was looked less favorably on this litigant hiring counsel 10 days prior to the summary judgment hearing, and so therefore a judge that a relatively short amount of time, eight months, was nonetheless sufficient. And there's an interesting footnote in that case at page 311, note 3, which admits, which for Judge Brister does not always happen, that that his decision to adjudge the 8 months to be an adequate time for discovery was admittedly in opposition to a Texas Supreme Court case, the Villegas v. Carter case, 711 Southwest 2nd, 624, 1986 case, that says that when a trial court allows an attorney to voluntarily withdraw time for new counsel to investigate, the trial court must give the party time for the new counsel to investigate the case and prepare for trial. And one could say that the trial court did that and did not abuse its discretion here if you consider the 5 days between five business days between when Mr. Smith appeared, filed his motion for continuance, and the summary judgment hearing occurred to be adequate time for discovery.
Yeah, but when Todd appeared, the first thing he did was ask for a continuance because he was running a campaign. So that's not a lawyer that's on his feet and ready to go. I mean, that's a lawyer that's coming in to get more time to create more delay.
Well, I think arguably, Judge Justice Duffino, that his campaign was part of his grounds, but it couldn't have sufficed as a ground for his motion for continuance because he wasn't currently serving, and there's no exception for running for office. But I do think that his moving for a continuance fit exactly into the Villegas case a view of the discretion that should be accorded new counsel when they come aboard to an existing case, which I think the trial court did not afford to Mrs. Mulcahy here.
But as soon as it was denied, he withdrew.
He did, but it was not denied until 5 business days later. He withdrew immediately after the court pronounced that orally, and then the court proceeded to grant both no evidence motions for summary judgment at the exact same hearing. So there was 5 days that elapsed technically as between when he appeared and when the no evidence summary judgments were granted.
But that 5 days doesn't take into account that she talked to him back in December, and he told her in December that because of the holidays he wasn't going to have time to look at it. Well, then she should have gone to some other attorney. She knew she was getting one motion for continuance. She shouldn't be allowed to just lay back and say, okay, well, because of the holidays he didn't have time to look at it. That 5 days doesn't take into account going back to December.
Well, I think Justice Gabriel, that the case law would not support that informal discussions with attorneys would be part of that time calculation. And it is not disputed here that he did make some attempts to do some informal discovery, but that has never been adjudged to be admissible evidence that could have countered no evidence summary judgment. So I think it is somewhat inapposite. Any informal discovery that he conducted in his trying to comply with his duties to see if he could fully represent her, because there wasn't any evidence that was developed during that time that was formal that could be would be sufficient to counter a no evidence summary judgment. I think the court's determination has to be from when he appeared or to when that hearing occurred, because those are the only two dates that are a matter of a record as far as the trial court was concerned.
She had a trial date back when her attorney withdrew in November.
Yes, ma'am.
She knew when the trial date was. She had a responsibility to go out and get an attorney who could handle her case and handle it under the time schedule that was in existence at that point in time.
Well, and I think you're correct, Justice, but I think the record would show that she did exactly that. As soon as she was made aware on November 30th, when her original counsel had withdrawn, and when Walmart filed its no evidence summary judgment motion, she had this dispositive motion that was pending against her. She filed her own pro se motion for a continuance to do exactly that, and work throughout the holidays to try to secure new representation so that she could meet that deadline. And it was at the January 4th hearing where the judge granted her 30 more days to find find counsel to be represented and then to respond to these motions. But really
she had in actuality an additional 60 days, because if she would have filed a motion for new trial and pointed out some type of evidence that would have been material that would have altered the outcome of the summary judgment, she could have filed a motion for reconsideration and said, hey, I didn't have time to depose this witness, and here's their affidavit that says something material. So really, we don't have anything in the record showing that even if she had been given additional time, other material evidence that would have generated a material issue of fact would have been uncovered.
I think that's right, Your Honor. The record is somewhat sparse there. I believe there is some evidence as to what the retention agreement as between Ms. Mulcahy and Todd Smith spelled out that made it clear that he was only going to appear insofar as he could, get this motion for continuance granted, and then they would proceed, forward on that basis. But you are exactly correct that there weren't any post-judgment motions filed, and there certainly was not any any evidence that would have shown, apart from what was in the motion for continuance, any evidence that could have countered the no evidence summary judgments.
What evidence did she ask for in her motion for continuance, or what specific, did she outline specific discovery that she wanted to undertake?
She outlined evidence that she would like to procure. It is a matter of debate as between the parties how specific that it actually was. The exact language from the motion for continuance asked for time to include the deposition testimony of the defendants, the representatives, agents, and or employees, plaintiffs treating physicians, and or any additional witnesses, which were not previously obtained by her prior attorney. So that, I think, sufficiently meets the test for showing that these were material items that she was seeking a motion for continuance in order to procure, and that she had been, which had not previously been obtained by her prior counsel. I think also under that third prong of the Fuqua test, the length of time that the case was active, also goes to a subpoint that we have raised as to whether or not that should be told when the court took into consideration that her prior counsel, you know, failed to conduct a single deposition to secure any affidavits, to designate any experts, which are fairly rudimentary aspects of a discovery that one would expect a trial lawyer to have undertaken in the 15 to 16 months.
But I thought that Walmart said that there were some depositions taken and there was some written discovery done.
Her deposition, Ms. Mulcahy's deposition, was indeed taken, and she had counsel that represented her at that deposition. There were no depositions taken for her benefit to develop evidence to support her case. And I believe the extent of her deposition of her discovery were four business records affidavits, which, you know, might have gone to showing some evidence of damage, but certainly not to all of the elements of her claims, which she was had the burden to provide evidence for once these no evidence summary judgment motions were filed.
Do you have any authority that the time period should be told?
It is a somewhat novel concept, Your Honor, and there is admittedly no Texas authority that would support it directly. But the closest analogy that I've come up with is that of fraudulent concealment, where you know, the statute of limitations is told where someone has been prevented from finding out the nature of their how they've been harmed due to the fraudulent actions of the concealer. Here, just as a matter of law, which of course is what's at issue in an open summary judgment, it seems a bit of a discretionary stretch to say that she was afforded an adequate time for discovery. If I think under any court's discretion, it would be hard pressed to say that her trial counsel acted competently, promptly, diligently, and did not neglect a legal matter or fail to carry out an obligation owed to clients if a single deposition wasn't taken, single affidavit wasn't secured, and
but
no experts were designated.
Fraudulent concealment, usually if that's tolling limitations, it is tolling it against the person or the party that engaged in the fraudulent concealment.
Yes,
and
yes,
so
Your Honor.
Here, Walmart didn't fraudulently conceal anything, and really isn't, if she has a cause of action concerning this alleged lack of conduct in accordance with the disciplinary rules, I mean, it would be against her attorney, wouldn't it?
I think that you're exactly right, Your Honor, that that the merits claim would lie against her trial counsel, and there is no debate on our side that the disciplinary rules of professional conduct are aimed at actions brought against your attorney via the state bar. And I think that you're right as well that the fraudulent concealment analogy is not quite as apt because it's being told against different parties, but it's the same underlying theory in that it's I think given the totality of the circumstances that would be examined under the seven-prong test in Fuqua the court could not have been said to have not abused its discretion in failing to grant this motion for continuance. I see that my time is running down. If there are no further questions.
Thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the court. I'm Ramona Martinez, and I'm representing Walmart in this matter. Simply put, this case is about the application of our uniform rules of procedure within the boundaries of standards and status well established by Texas courts across this state. The trial court and the appellee should not be held responsible for the appellant's shortcomings in pursuing her litigation. I will be addressing three issues: whether the trial court abused its discretion in determining that the appellant had an adequate time for discovery before the appellees filed their summary judgments, whether competent and diligent counsel really impacts that analysis at all, and whether Walmart's summary judgment was properly granted by the trial court. Mr. Mills will be addressing the waiver arguments, whether the trial court abused its discretion in denying the motion for continuance, and whether assembled product summary judgment was properly granted. Your Honor, focusing on the issue that the appellants brought up first, as it relates to the factors that the courts evaluate, when you look at the time the case is active and the amount of time that this summary judgment was on file, you are not going to find an abuse of discretion by the trial court. The trial court used or could have arguably did refer to the Texas Supreme Court rules of judicial administration in evaluating the length of time that cases stay on its docket. In fact, Hood County incorporates the Supreme Court rules of judicial administration into its local rules. And under Rule 6, civil cases need to be brought to trial or final disposition within 18 months of the time of appearance. And those are the standards that this court applied to the appellants in this case. The summary judgments were heard within that time period, and the case was brought within the 18 months. They did.
But we can't forget that we're dealing with individuals, and it's not a hard and fast rule, and you've got to look at the circumstances, and cases don't just go poof into the ether at 18 months if they're not heard. There are always things that have to be considered by the trial court, and if we get more hung up on form than we do on substance rules rather than what we hear about, then justice isn't done for anybody. So, yeah, that's a goal that the judges, trial judges, have. But the judges also have discretion when there are special circumstances. In fact, the judges have to exercise discretion. So,
absolutely, Your Honor. And in fact, when you're analyzing these cases, it really is done on a case-by-case basis. The courts look at the facts that are involved in each particular case. But if you look at the cases that are similar to what we have here, both with the factors that plaintiff thinks is of issue. When we're looking at premises liability cases, you have two courts, the Strahan and the Bostic Court, that determined that 10 and 14 months was a sufficient time for discovery to occur. And even in cases where a plaintiff is pro se, for most of the time a case has been on file, and that's the Carter and the Restaurant Teams International case. Under those two cases, the court determined that 7 and 8 months was a sufficient amount of time to conduct discovery. So we're not losing the factor or the discretion of the court, because each court has to look at what's going on. And it's our contention that the trial court evaluated the amount of time the case was on discovery, was on file, in making its ultimate determination. In fact, when the appellant filed her first motion for continuance off the initial summary judgments, I think that is an example of the court's discretion to give the plaintiff an opportunity at that point in time to address the significant issues of having a summary judgment filed against her. likewise having a trial setting in early February, which plaintiff was on notice not only at the time when her counsel withdrew in November, but when her initial counsel withdrew many months earlier than that. She was on notice of what that trial setting is.
Does the record reflect why all these lawyers kept withdrawing?
It does not, Your Honor. Mulcahy testified at the motion for continuance hearing that her second counsel that withdrew said he did that because he didn't have sufficient funds or that the case would be too costly. That's the only testimony that we have in the record related to why that counsel withdrew. We have no information related to why the initial counsel withdrew in that case. But arguably, Ms. Mulcahy was represented by at least one counsel, if not multiple counsels, for 16 months. And that 16 months is an adequate window to conduct discovery in from the standards that the courts have evaluated the nature of these type of cases. These are not complex cases. Both of these cases fall within the discovery level two, which indicates that discovery must be conducted within 9 months after the first response to a written discovery. And the Rule 190 does not distinguish between the type of cases that are pled, whether they're premises cases or products liability cases, because what we have here is a case that could have been or an opportunity for discovery to be handled within that 9-month period of time. And arguably, had plaintiff desired, there was 16 months for her counsel to do that bit of discovery. So from the standpoint of the factors that are before this court, all of those factors weigh in favor of the appellants on the Fuqua test. The adequacy of counsel really doesn't come into play. This court knows that the right to counsel doesn't extend to civil cases. And arguably, when you're looking at the adequacy of counsel issue, the adequacy of time to conduct discovery doesn't really talk about did the lawyer conduct discovery. It's whether there was a window, a period, an opportunity to conduct that discovery that courts are looking at. And the appellant in this case was given that window of opportunity to conduct discovery.
There's no claim that appellees in any way prevented discovery or avoided providing information or avoided providing things that have been requested and should have been properly turned over?
Absolutely, Your Honor. There is not any evidence of that. The parties cooperated in discovery. Written discovery was exchanged. Plaintiff's deposition was taken. The record does not reflect any motions to compel, any discovery disputes, any frustration of the discovery process by the appellees in this process, in this case.
And wasn't there some attempt to settle through mediation, or is this the case that there was some mediation?
Yes, Your Honor. The record does reflect that mediation was had shortly after the plaintiff's deposition and prior to her counsel withdrawing from the lawsuit. So the parties did engage in mediation before the court ultimately made its decisions in this case.
And there was no discovery then during that period of mediation?
I'm sorry?
No discovery during that period of mediation.
No discovery was had. The records were filed after the mediation. The records that the plaintiff obtained and obtained the affidavits, those were filed after the mediation. But that was the only activity that occurred after that mediation process. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you.
May it please the court. I'm colorblind, so if I miss the colors, sing
out. They're lined up.
They're lined up. So okay, I can watch that.
All the way
I can see that. I can
line.
See that now, sitting over there.
Time.
I couldn't. Okay. I represent the Appellee Assembled Products Corporation, one of the defendants in trial court. The action against Assembled Products was in strict liability. I am going to address 3 points. First, the trial court did not abuse his discretion denying the motion for continuance. Second, the contention that the appellant waived any right to complain about lack of effective counsel at trial. Third, that the trial court properly granted the motion for summary judgment for assembled products. In his reply brief, the plaintiff cited the law correctly on the first point, no abuse of discretion in denying the motion for continuance. And that was in the case that is Joe versus 239 JV, and that's cited in the appellant's reply brief. In Joe, which was a Texas Supreme Court case, the Supreme Court said, of course, that a court may order a continuance of a summary judgment hearing if it appears from the affidavits of a party opposing the motion that he cannot, for reasons stated, present by affidavit facts essential to justify his opposition. Whether or not the court committed a clear abuse of discretion is decided on a case-by-case basis. A trial court abuses its discretion when it reaches a decision arbitrary and unreasonable, so much so that it amounts to a clear and prejudicial error of law. The court cited factors that it looks at in making that determination under Rule 166AG. Those factors are the length of time that the case has been on file, the materiality and purpose of the discovery sought, and whether the party seeking the continuance has exercised due diligence to obtain the discovery sought. That's not under the argument that there was inadequate time for discovery, but under the general rules on continuance of a motion for summary judgment hearing. Let's apply those factors to our case. First, the length of time that the case had been on trial. We all know that by the time of the hearing, it had been on file for almost 18 months. When I filed the motion for summary judgment for assembled products on November 4, 2009, it had been on file for 15 months. That motion was filed before the actual deadline had expired to designate experts, so the plaintiff could have designated experts, before the discovery deadline for experts, so the plaintiff could have taken those depositions. At that time, the plaintiff was represented by counsel. No discovery requests were made, and no depositions were taken. No affidavits were filed. That hearing wasn't set until January of 2010. So we have more than 60 days between the time I filed the motion and the time of the initial setting on the motion for summary judgment.
I have a question.
Yes.
Does a party have to file a response to a no evidence motion?
A party has to file a response to a proper no evidence motion.
As I'm sitting here looking at the rule, and it just says that the party can file a no evidence motion if there's no evidence of one or more essential elements of a claim or defense, which an adverse party would have the burden of proof. The motion must state the elements as to which there is no evidence. The court must grant the motion unless the respondent produces summary judgment evidence raising a genuine issue of material fact. So if there's summary judgment evidence in the record, summary judgment is like a trial, and there's summary judgment evidence in the record, can the court consider it without a response? Can the court consider the business record affidavits that were on file and her deposition?
The court could consider those matters, but if they did not raise genuine issues of material fact,
all right, so that's what I'm asking.
That doesn't get them to that point.
Her deposition and the four business record affidavits concerning her medical expenses don't raise a genuine issue of material fact on any of her causes of action, which would include negligence?
That would be our position, Your Honor. Those do not raise genuine issues of material fact. Okay. And particularly, then, let's move on to the element of diligence. There is no evidence of the record of any diligence that was taken by the plaintiff in order to obtain the discovery that was listed in the motion for continuance. No evidence that the prior attorney who had the case for more than 16 months, what diligence he sought to get that, no evidence that we, the appellees, did anything to slow down the discovery process or interfere with the discovery process. There are no motions to compel, no motions for sanctions or anything like that in the record.
What I'm hearing you say and what I seem to understand the trial judge said was there is a no evidence summary judgment motion. You have announced not ready for trial, therefore I'm granting the motion for summary judgment. Because you had her deposition where she set out her view of the lawsuit and her view of the evidence, so you had her testimony. You had medical records.
Well, the medical records do not address the elements of a strict liability cause of action. Her deposition does not create a fact issue on the elements of strict liability or negligence or products liability. It tells how the accident happened, but that doesn't reach the elements of the motion for summary judgment, that being that there was no evidence of an unreasonably dangerous product at the time it was manufactured and sent to Walmart. There's no evidence of that. Not in her deposition, not in the medical records, or otherwise.
Any questions?
Thank you.
I'd like to make it just a few brief points in response. I wanted to address a few of the questions that the court has asked. Just Stofno, as to your questions about the order of counsel, it's not entirely clear from the record, but it appears that the whole time, from the time she filed suit in August 8th of 2008 until he withdrew November 30th of 2009, the same day that Walmart filed their no evidence summary judgment, she was represented by the same counsel, Chad Elsley, I believe his name was. For purposes, I believe, of the mediation, she had some additional counsel that signed on in June of 2009 and then withdrew in August of 2009. So I believe that's kind of the order of appearance and withdrawal of counsel. And then, of course, Todd Smith, who appeared and withdrew the same day or within 5 days. And then also, too, I believe you'd asked a question about Rule 6 of the Texas Supreme Court Rules of Judicial Administration. You are correct that those are more or less, for lack of a better term, aspirational, and that each case, and I think the appellees would agree with this, the cases are judged on a case-by-case basis. But I did want to let the court know that our independent research has not turned up a single no evidence summary judgment case or a case that was examining the factors under Fuqua, which cited to the Judicial Rules of Administration as evidence, you know, that 18-month time period as being per se evidence of being an adequate time for a discovery. Walker, you had asked about whether or not a response is required when a no evidence summary judgment is filed. I think there are two things to consider there. I think that the rule itself, 166AI, is a little bit broadly worded as to whether or not mere evidence that already exists in the record but which was not technically attached to a response may be considered. And I'm sure that both sides would be happy to submit supplemental briefing on that point. I would venture to say that it would be a harder case to make if it's not attached than if it had been attached as proof in your response. And, of course, there was no response here. But you very well may be correct that just its mere existence that the court in its discretion can consider that. And you are correct as well that the test for that is whether a genuine issue of material fact has been raised. And that, of course, since Judge Brister's opinion, which redefined legal sufficiency, really comes down to a matter as to whether reasonable minds could could differ on any given point. If they could, then it's more than a scintilla, ergo, therefore, it's a genuine issue of a material fact. One other point I want to make very quickly, Strahan case, which was a premises liability case, which found it inadequate time for discovery, had occurred with 12 months, with only 12 months having elapsed. A little bit of a factual distinction there, that where the court hinged its opinion on that analysis was that the witnesses that they proposed, that they sought a continuance in order to depose, were not going to provide any evidence as to causation, which is what the issue was there. So it didn't matter who they deposed, it wasn't going to provide any evidence that would defeat the summary judgment. Whereas here, witnesses that they sought to depose in their motion for continuance would have gone to all the elements that they needed to, that they had the burden to rebut in an open summary judgment. Thank you very much.
Any other questions? All right. Thank you. Appreciate your argument. Your case is submitted. You're free to go about your business or stay in the courtroom and watch the next case.